This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the January 2026 issue of Arizona Highways. I'll start out today with an essay by Frank Waters entitled The Canyon. Editor's note, as we begin a new year, we continue the celebration of our centennial with another classic from our archive. This month's piece was written by Frank Waters, a prolific award-winning author from New Mexico who spent his winters in Tucson. When he died at the age of 92, his eulogist said, Frank Waters is unique in American literature. With the exception of William Faulkner, no other novelist has produced as many classics, and Frank is wiser and kinder than Faulkner, deeper than Hemingway, tougher than Steinbeck. This was a very great writer. Lofty peaks, whole mountains, rise out of its depths. There are vast plateaus, flat-top mesas, high buttes, and monoliths. And all of these are carved in the semblance of pyramids, temples, castles, of pinnacles, spires, fluted columns and towers, porticos and abutments, bridges and arches, terraces, balconies, balustrades. If I were forced to describe so sublime an immensity, I would define it with only one word, the ancient Sanskrit word for the non-existent material world of the senses, maya, or illusion. It embodies all that man has ever achieved of the knowledge of reality, that all matter, as our own science now suspects, is but a manifestation of that primordial energy constituting the electron, whose ultimate source is mind, and hence illusory and insubstantial. Grand Canyon seems such a world whose very mountains are but the shifting, dissolving, recreated thoughts of the one omnipotent mind. It is beyond sensory perception. It lies in the realm of metaphysics, the world of illusion, maya. No one is ever prepared for the canyon as one is for the gradually rising Rockies as he approaches across the plains. One simply crosses a flat plateau, hirsute with cedar and great pines, and there at his feet it suddenly yawns, the Rocky Mountains upside down, an immense intaglio instead of a cameo, a mountain chain, as it were, nearly 300 miles long, up to 18 miles wide, but a mile deep instead of a mile high. Say this, and there is no more to be said. See it in one look, and there's nothing more to see. A competent writer, justly noted in his generation for his appreciation of Western America, once described the first impact of the canyon by relating that he had seen strong men break down and weep. Sensational bosh. I think more of the curt remark of that old Westerner who at first sight is reported to have shrugged and said, "Now by Jesus, I know where we can throw our old safety razor blades." Like all great things, the canyon takes time to appreciate. So be wary of your companion's instant rhapsody of applause. Be more wary of that sacred hush affected by others. Simply take your look, turn on your heel and leave. The canyon will be there if you ever return. And if you are drawn back, you will know then that it is a great experience not to be taken lightly and not before you are ready for it. El Tovar on the South Rim, Fred Harvey's luxurious oasis of the terminus of the Santa Fe Railroad spur and the highway for Williams, Arizona, has long been the stranger's starting point. From there, convenient government roads lead to several other points of vantage: Hopi Point, Yavapai Point, Grand View Point, Desert View, and Lipan Point, just off the road between these latter. At their tidy observation lookouts provided with telescopes, you can briefly encompass a faint idea of the main canyon's length of 277 miles and its average width of 12 miles. For the first time, the absurdity of a letter to M.R. Tillotson, former superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park, will strike you as funny. He relates that a Hollywood movie director once wrote him requesting aid in selecting a convenient scenic spot where his cinematic hero could be filmed in the act of jumping a horse across the canyon. Actually, the chasm is so long and wide that it has prevented the migration of animals to and from the forest on each side. Only on the Kaibab Plateau to the north are found the Kaibab white-tailed squirrels, known for their tufted ears. Parachutists have been dropped on certain buttes to search for prehistoric forms of animal life possibly isolated in the canyon. In this largest virgin forest in the United States roam queer dwarf burros that have strayed here, gone wild, inbred, and become stunted. The North Rim abounds in deer. A government trapper killed 500 mountain lions in 4 years. Winding down to the bottom are two easy horseback trails, Hermit, and Bright Angel. Descend one of these, and the third dimension of the canyon begins to be apparent, its appalling depth, a sheer drop of 1 mile from the south rim and 1,300 feet more from the north rim. Remembering that 1 mile in altitude is comparable to 800 miles of latitude, you can travel here the equivalent distance from central Mexico to northern Canada. It is a trail that drops from a snowstorm at the rim into semi-tropical weather at the river below, and one which leads through all the zones of plant life from the mesquite of the lower Sonora zone through the upper Sonora and transition to the quaking aspen of the Canadian zone. In length, breadth, and width, the canyon grows. Its mirror immensity takes hold. Yet these dimensions are but its frame. Like a drug, the more of it you take in, the more you want. Often, riding through the forest along its rim, I have come across lone wanderers held there a month, a year, a lifetime, by nothing more than its strange and indefinable quality of compelling fascination. Ostensibly, there are vacationists, photographers, and artists, mere sheep herders, old hunters, and trappers, even those waiting for the world to come to an end. But it is a canyon that holds them. It is the most powerful mesmer I know. What is there in it that exerts so universal an appeal? For one thing, it contains every shape known to man. Lofty peaks, whole mountains rise out of its depths. There are vast plateaus, flat-topped mesas, high buttes, and monoliths. And all of these are carved in the semblance of pyramids, temples, castles, of pinnacles, spires, fluted columns and towers, porticos and abutments, bridges and arches, terraces, balconies, balustrades. They are solid and fragile, bare and covered with latticework and delicate carving. It is a stage that seems expressly built to contain its perpetuity appropriate sets for every dynasty, every religion, every legend and myth drama that man has known, a vast universal depository, as it were, of mankind's structural and architectural heritage. Cardenas and his men, the first Europeans we know to look into the canyon, saw in it shapes resembling the towers of their beloved Seville. Cardenas Butte is named for him, another for Coronado, who headed the first land expedition into the region, and Alarcon Terrace for the first ship captain to ascend the river. Named for the pre-Columbian race of Mexico, which they conquered, is Aztec Amphitheater, and for the race that preceded it, Toltec Point. There is a point for ancient Cintiotl and one for Quetzal, which gave a name to the vanished mysterious Quetzal bird and the legendary feathered serpent god Quetzalcoatl. For the Greeks, there are temples named for Apollo, Castor, and Pollux. For the Romans, the temples of Jupiter, Juno, and Diana. The Christian Bible is not forgotten. There is a temple here for Solomon, more enduring than one made of Lebanon cedars, and another for Sheba that will last as long as a fable of her beauty. Here, far from Egypt's land, is Cleopatra Pyramid, a tower of Ra, and the temples of Horus, Isis, and Osiris. There is a Persian temple for Zoroaster, Chinese temples for Mencius and Confucius. There are temples for Buddha, Brahma, and Devi, a Krishna shrine, and a temple for Manu, who throughout the destruction and rebirth of all continents, all worlds, watches over the progressive evolution of all life, including that of man, its latest form. Here, as nowhere else, are background and settings spacious and majestic enough for the great Germanic myth drama. Across the Titanic Canyon to the Walhalla Plateau could race the winged steeds of the Valkyries, carrying heroes killed in battle. There is Wotan's throne, castles for Gunther and Freya, a lofty promontory named for Thor, with room to swing the mighty hammer whose blows echo back and forth from the canyon walls, and Siegfried Pyre, forever flaming in fiery rock. So too are the English myth dramas of the Arthurian legend and the quest of the Holy Grail recapitulated in enduring stone. Here stands King Arthur's castle with that of Guinevere. There is another for Sir Galahad and one for the tragic maid Elaine to stand in, grieving at his casements for the peerless knight's return. There rises Lancelot Point. There yawns Gawain Abyss. Holy Grail Temple still holds at dawn and sunset the light no man saw on its tragic quest. Here is a mighty stone named for the magic sword Excalibur, itself first drawn from stone. Still others are named for the magician Merlin, the traitor Mordred. Point after point emerges to mark all of these, simply named for the people who have always known this as their traditional homeland, Apache Point for the mother tribe and others for its sub-tribes, the Hilarillo, Mescalero, and Mimbres Apaches, still others for the Hopi, Navajo, Huevapai, Pima, Yavapai, Papago, Cocopa, and Comanche. So they loom out of time and space, a named minimum out of the vast, anonymous multitude. What shape or form has man ever conceived of mind and built by the hand that the canyon does not hold? Is that its secret that holds a watcher at his brim to see foretold in it the yet unborn form of his wildest imagining, the shape of his secret longing? Why, many a man has hardly noticed shapes in it at all. They are merely blobs of color, color so rich and rampant that it floods the whole chasm, so powerful that it dissolves like acid all the shapes within it. Here, if you will, is a drama whose characters are colors, the royal purples, the angry reds, the mellow russets and monkish browns, soothing blues, shrieking yellows, tragic blacks and mystic whites, cool greens, pale lavenders, and anemic grays. A lifetime is too short to watch their infinite variations in key and tone. They change with every season, every hour, and every change in light and weather. In the blinding glare of a summer's noon, its tints are so muted that the canyon seems a delicate pastel. But watch it at sunset. The yellows slowly deepen to orange, the salmon pinks to reds, the greens and blue grays to damson blue, the lilacs to purple. Sunrise reverses the process. The whole chasm lifts bodily, inch by inch, toward light. The paint pot tips and spills over. The colors run and seep down the walls, collecting in pools below. If it is a picture, winter frames it best, preferably after a heavy snowfall when the plateaus are solid white, and better yet, when every twig and needle is still sheathed in ice. Deeply inset in such a frame, the canyon has all the warmth and color of a child's stereopticon slide held up to the table lamp. Into it snow never descends. A summer rainstorm is more potent. There, mists and clouds are formed below. Like tiny puffs from father's pipe, they spurt out of the warm canyons and, swelling like balloons, gradually float to the surface. The cold, clear, cloudless days of October, that is its time. Its colors stand out, flat and positive, relate it not to the universal, but to the earth in which it is set. Red Supai group sandstone, the rich red rock with the Indian name, the bright yellow Indian earth that stains land and river alike and gives both their name. Green Tonto group shell, green as pine and sage, bright as turquoise, clear as a turquoise sky above. Red and green on limestone white. These are its distinctive colors, as they are the colors of the old Hopi ceremonial sashes, the mass of the giant Zuni Shalako, the Navajo blankets, the fine old blankets of Chimayo, so faded with their lost and unduplicated colors. In this, of course, I must own to a sentimental but helpless preference. This is my land, and to it I belong with all it expresses and with all by which it is expressed. It is merely a matter of vibration. We are each keyed to that band of the spectrum that determines our own tone. Little wonder, then, that the canyon is universal in appeal. It is a complete spectrum, and in its vast range there is no one who does not find their own harmonic key. Color is a mysterious thing. Within the written memory of man, as we know, there was a time when he could not distinguish between the blue of the sky and the green of the forest. Still, today, there are colors not all of us can perceive. But they are there in the canyon, a thousand gradations, invisible and unnamed, yet each vibrating upon our consciousness. Is this the music of the spheres that fills us so with wonder, a celestial symphony of color that drives us to still another terminology to express the inexpressible feeling it evokes? In an instant, the whole thing is forgotten when suddenly, after midnight, a slash of lightning rips through the dark. One hears the bolt strike. It is as if it has cracked the hinge of a canyon wall. A cliff caves in. It tears down another, and it another, like the collapse of a pack of stacked cards, a tremendous and prolonged shattering, accompanied by a thunderous concatenation traveling down the whole canyon. Before it is over, you have thrown off your blankets and raced half naked to the rim. This is the end of the world as predicted. Bolt after bolt strikes into the gorge. In the hot, dry air, sheets of flame light up the crumbling buttes and peaks. A second later, they have vanished, swallowed by a vacuous immensity of flame red and pitch black. It grows greater and greater to the echo of thunderclaps thrown back and forth from the remaining walls, an inferno bathed in fire, a chaotic underworld. This is the apocalypse, the most awful and most sublime sight you can experience. Before it, you can cling to opinion, insensitive to self, the shrieking wind, and the lash of rain. As suddenly it is over, the last reverberation dies away. Overpowering silence breaks louder upon the eardrums. In this monstrous, unearthly calm, the first light of day breaks over the cliff tops. They are still standing, and in the clarity of rain-washed dawn, you see a world reborn in the semblance of the old, but new, enthrallingly new. And this concludes The Canyon. The scenic drive for January 2026 is Copper Corridor Scenic Road. Articles written by Noah Austin. Copper mining has fueled Arizona's economy since the 1800s, and the state is full of towns rooted in the ongoing search for that precious mineral. This paved drive connects two of those towns, Globe and Winkleman, and while you won't see much mining activity from the road, you will encounter mountain vistas, a desert river, and a dash of American history. From U.S. Route 70, just east of the Globe area, head south on State Route 77, also known as the Copper Corridor Scenic Road, an Arizona Department of Transportation designation that also applies to State Route 177 to the west. Yuccas and mesquites dot the roadsides early on, and you'll see the Hayes Mountains to the southeast on San Carlos Apache tribe land as you roll through the foothills of the Pinal Mountains. Within a few miles, the road begins a steep climb, and 8.4 miles in, you'll reach the literal high point of the drive, 4,983 feet at El Capitan Pass, where there's a large overlook with shaded picnic tables. As a historical marker there explains, the Army of the West, commanded by Stephen W. Kearney and guided by Kit Carson, traversed the pass en route to California in 1846 during the Mexican-American War. Today it offers panoramas of the surrounding mountains and distant Globe and Miami. The road begins a gentle descent after the pass, eventually dipping into prickly pear cactuses and other high desert vegetation. The cliff walls around you get higher as you descend farther into El Capitan Canyon, which runs between the Pinals to the west and the Mescal Mountains to the east. At mile 13, you'll get an excellent view of the Pinals on the right. A mile later, on the left, a long, exposed cliff looms over a landscape of agaves and ocotillos. The next couple of miles are a steeper descent, steep enough that two runaway truck ramps are provided. Saguaros quickly appear as you lose elevation, and to the south, layers of mountain ridges stretch to the horizon. You'll keep descending, but not as severely, until mile 23, when you'll cross a bridge over dripping springs wash and turn sharply to the right. This turn marks the final stretch of the drive, which parallels the Gila River, one of the longest waterways in the American West, on the left. From the road, it's difficult to see the river itself, but you'll see the thick riparian canopy along it and the healthy saguaros on the nearby canyon walls. Starting around mile 27, the road does offer a good look at tall cottonwoods nourished by the Gila. For a view of the actual river, pull off at the Shores Recreation Site managed by the Federal Bureau of Land Management at mile 29.4. At this minimally developed site, gravel roads lead to several primitive campsites along the Gila. The easy access makes it a haven for anglers in search of warm water fish, including channel catfish, carp, and largemouth bass. Even if you didn't pack a rod and reel, the sights and sounds of a running river in this arid land are worth a quick stop. From there, it's only a few miles to the end of this drive at SR 177 in Winkleman. You can take that road north to Superior and the Phoenix area, or continue south on SR 77 to Tucson. Either way, the views are as good as gold, or in this case, copper. And this concludes Copper Canyon Scenic Road. The hike of the month for January 2026 is Doe Mountain Trail. Articles written by Robert Steve. A doe is a deer, a female deer, and there are many in the wilderness surrounding Sedona, silently tiptoeing through the drops of golden sun. At some point, presumably, one of them, or maybe several, did something out of the ordinary and inspired the locals to name a flat-top mesa after her. The origin story of Dough Mountain isn't clear, but there's no confusion about what's in store on top. Only a hot air balloon offers a view as vast as what you'll see on the upper end of this trail. Dough Mountain is a short climb with epic 360-degree views and great ledges for photo ops, says Kegan Marissa Hall, a Sedona native and avid adventurer. It's a local favorite. It's easy to see why. It's a beauty. What's more, the trail recently went through an extensive upgrade at a cost of $130,000 that included the installation of rock steps, retaining walls, and erosion control, as well as two new loop trails on top. The loops extend an otherwise short route to 3 miles. It's still a quick trip, but so is the trail to Cathedral Rock. Better short and sweet than long and lax, the Scots say. This short hike shares a parking lot with the Bear Mountain Trail. Perhaps their names are rooted in the same 19th century tale. From the pavement, the freshly groomed track begins an immediate ascent. The dirt is red and the route is well marked, like the zebra crossings in Piccadilly Circus. Within a few minutes, you'll come to an intersection with the Airy Trail, which looks in tandem with the Coxcomb Trail to create a loop around the base of the mountain. Continuing up, veer right, then left, and follow the rock steps up the north side of the mountain to the switchbacks, which are gradual and effective. The trail restoration is especially noticeable along this stretch. Another thing you'll note is the quiet nature of things, despite the mountain's proximity to the uptown hubbub. About 20 minutes in, 0.7 miles, the trail cuts through a narrow chute in a massive rock and arrives at the top of the mesa. You have 3 choices at this point. 1, go forward to Dough Overlook. 2, turn right for the south loop. Or 3, go left for the north loop. The locals like to go left, and by following in their footsteps, you'll get a distant look at Jerome and a closer look at Bear Mountain and Fay Canyon. Ravens and Stellar's jays voice their displeasure with the uninvited. In spite of their noise, you'll see manzanitas, junipers, and other high desert vegetation as you wind around the west side of the mesa and move north. It's there that civilization enters the picture. 2 roads can be seen, and homes are scattered here and there. Turns out Sedona is not virgin territory anymore, and that draws some boos. For a long time, the city has been disparaged for its growth. They should have made this place into a national park, people say. To be sure, that would have been nice, but the same thing could be said about so many other picturesque places. Aspen, Door County, the High Peaks region around Lake George, the hilly promontory overlooking the Mediterranean where the Phoenicians built Carthage. People clutter landscapes, but not all of them. The top of Dough Mountain remains untouched, and the landscape surrounding it is mostly clear. It's not a national park, but it's a healthy antidote to that empty feeling of what might have been. You'll feel some of that as you hike around to the east side and come to Dough Lookout. From there, you can take the shortcut back to the west side or merge onto the south loop. The locals take the loop, which is less defined than its counterpart. However, cairns, a useful tool but a violation of leave no trace, mark the way. As you head back to the west side in the final descent, you'll see Mezquel Mountain, Wilson Mountain, and the Coxcomb, the southernmost formation in Red Rock Country. What you won't see are deer. You could, but you probably won't, and it won't matter. The solitude, scenery, and drops of golden sun will do. And this concludes Dough Mountain Trail. I'll conclude today's reading with a few letters to the editor. Thank you for publishing As Different as Night and Day by Annette McGivney in the September 2025 issue. It's one of the best articles I've read. I especially appreciated its spiritual aspect. Plus, the ending was perfection. I hope you will enter it in a magazine writing contest and continue publishing articles with a spiritual aspect, submitted by Heather Chase of Sedona, Arizona. I enjoyed your article about Teufel, the toy store in Prescott. I will make a point of visiting their store the next time I'm up there. I would like to suggest another really fun retail shop in Tucson called Mildred and Dildred. My friend and I love to go in and play with the many retro and wind-up toys. This happy environment can't help but make you smile. Submitted by Nikki Bellio of Tucson. The essay by Marvin Weiss, The Golden Autumn, October 2025, was the most vividly recorded essay on the marvels of this season I have ever read. In his vignette, his word of the word gold or golden displays the force and fashion of autumn like no other. I'd also like to comment on Claire Curran's excellent photography in that issue, especially the photo on pages 32 and 33. All the visible colors of the spectrum are presented in that photo. This is genius photography. I have one last thought, this one about the September issue. In his editor's letter, Robert Steve references In a Gata de Vida, which was released in 1968 by Iron Butterfly. The soundtrack features a drum solo that is arguably the most famous of all time. It must have sounded awesome blaring from the back of the Barracuda, submitted by Jeff Franklin of Surprise, Arizona. Editor's note, boy, did it ever. That photo on the inside front cover, August 2025, is the best. I'm no expert, but the picture stopped me. I had to study it. The waterfall, the creek, the composition, the light, the cliff and trees, the flat area with the dead tree. Beautiful. Over the hill is the craziness, but here in this valley is quiet and peaceful. The picture has all that. Also, the map on page one is so helpful, puts it all together, so clear. I needed that little map, submitted by Carol Zundel of Boise, Idaho. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.